Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, WCTCAM.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis. How are you?
I'm well indeed. Thank you very much.
You know, this morning, I want to talk about one of the things that I enjoy about the restaurant business. That's there is still some humor in the job that I do every day. There's still just a little bit of good humor, pleasantry, comedy.
To what comedy do you refer?
Well, one of the things I still get to do in our restaurant is no one in my organization gets hired without speaking to either Francis or me. Every single person who comes into the organization, their final interview is with Francis or me. So a lot of people fall out of the process before they talk to us. And, you know, there are lots of steps in that process. And sometimes people wonder why there might be three or four interviews for a bus person position. But Francis and I take very seriously whom we hire. Well, invariably, someone will go through the process who maybe shouldn't get all the way to Francis or me. And I'm always curious at some of the answers to some of the questions. Well, just recently, just as a matter of fact, last night, I was interviewing somebody who had what I'll call a bad answer to a question. And Francis and I were sitting in the office and we were interviewing a young lady, a very nice young lady, but a young lady who really didn't understand our jobs, who really didn't understand didn't get what we do. And so one of the questions I ask, and so if you are applying for a job, I'll give you, if you're a listener, you can get a little leg up on one of the questions I always ask, because what you do is you trail in our restaurant. You spend a few hours trailing somebody in our restaurant to get an idea of what we do, to observe what we do, and so we can observe you in the atmosphere.
It saves a lot of time, because a lot of people come to observe and go, oh, that's too hard. I'm not doing that. You guys are crazy.
So one of the questions I asked, I said, what did you see today that during your trail that you didn't like, that was disconcerting or disquieting to you? And the young lady answered very honestly, which I appreciate, but she answered very honestly. She said, you know, in the area in the wait station where the service assistants are waiting to do things, there's no chair back there. She said there was no chair back there.
No, there's not.
There was no place to sit down. And I thought to myself, and this young lady, and we do hire people with no experience sometimes, but I thought to myself, this young lady really doesn't understand that
there's never time to sit down during serving service.
Well, you may be on your feet for 14 and a half out of 15 hours in a day sometimes. What we have is a very difficult and very physical job. And I'm always amazed, and that's obviously just one tiny little story, but I'm always amazed at how people looking from the outside in don't always have, and I think a lot of our listeners through a lot of these stories do have a pretty good grasp of.
Or worked in a fine dining restaurant and get it.
Of how the restaurant business works. That I'm always amazed when somebody really has gone through layers of our interview process.
Well, and has followed the staff for an evening.
And has followed our staff who is
for 2 hours.
Diligent, hardworking, devoted, and would never think of sitting down during while customers were in the restaurant.
Funny.
Just wouldn't be part of that process. I'm always curious at the things that people will say to one another when maybe they should think twice before they speak.
Yeah, 100%. I completely agree. I think it's nice that we're able to interview everybody and that we make all the hiring and firing decisions in the restaurant. I think that's very important. And fortunately, it's not very many firing.
But even so, somebody will get through the process sometimes and get hired. And you know, I'm thinking of a guy who worked for us. He probably worked for us for a week or so. Basically just got through the training period of the restaurant. And I remember he turned to one of the waiters and he said, So you guys get cash tips and then you allocate them out to one another? And we said, or one of the waiters, I wasn't there. One of the waiters said, yeah, we collect all the cash tips and then we allocate them to everybody fairly.
In a pooled house.
And he said, oh, I can't wait to be a waiter. There's no way I'm giving my cash back out.
He's going to steal the cash tip.
And the waiters, basically I had 8 people come down to my office and say, yeah, you got to fire this guy today.
It's funny. I remember, you know, the whole, like, whether you're in a pool house where the waiters all pool their tips, or you're in a house where the waiters tip out the bartenders and the bussers, and the bartender mm-hmm. tips out the waiters for running food, and the, you know, either way, there's always a tip out among
the front
of house.
There's always some kind of
sharing.
Honor system
right.
that exists.
And I always remember I worked in a restaurant before the restaurant where we worked together. It was my first restaurant job where I was a bartender and a waiter. And there was this one waitress who everybody knew that undertipped the busboys. And the way the demographic worked in this restaurant way back then, I do remember that the busboys were all these Mexican guys that didn't speak English and were awesome at their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And the waiters were a mix of college kids and homemakers and, you know, people who had most of us were part-time. It was a burger joint, but a pub and a burger joint. And there was this one waitress whose reputation was everybody knew that she didn't tip out the full amount that she's supposed to the bussers. Now, these guys worked very hard, and I view that, and most people in the restaurant business view that as simply stealing.
Stealing.
And not stealing from your boss, stealing from your coworkers.
Right. Stealing from a peer is even worse than stealing from your boss.
It's all bad, by the way. But I remember that one day she went out after work, and I'm not condoning this, but I remember that one day she drove a Volkswagen Beetle, and she went out to work in the parking lot one day, and the Beetle was upside down. and Beetles look really funny when they're upside down, but let's just say that she should have tipped the busboys. Just say that that was one of being an unwise decision.
That's not a funny story.
Nobody felt bad for her. I'd say nobody felt, Donna's car's upside down. Oh, look at that. Oh, well. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be talking with a gentleman named Scott Beatty about his new book, Artisanal Cocktails, Drinks Inspired from the Seasons, from the bar at Cyrus. He's from San Francisco, and he's an important new voice in mixology. So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant and Cocktail Bar in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And today we're talking with Scott Beatty. His book, Artisanal Cocktails, Drinks Inspired from the Seasons from the Bar at Cyrus, is one of the nicest, prettiest, and most interesting books on cocktails to be released this season.
Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, your book isn't just an average cocktail book. We got to talk a moment or two before we came on the air, and we talked about a friend of ours and someone we both admire a great deal in the cocktail world who's come out with a new book, Dale DeGroff, who's been on the show many times and who's been in my house many times making me drinks. And your book, they both come out at about the same time. It's a great basic book. We're going to have Dale on the show again to talk about his new book. But your book isn't about cocktails in general and the art of being a barman from a basic level. It's a very specific kind of cocktail book. Why don't you tell us about sort of your vision of this book and the kind of cocktails you make and write about in this book?
Well, I think the book is really about potential and about possibilities. You know, I'm from San Francisco. I'm from an urban area, and I've lived outside of the city now for about 8 years. Half that time was in Napa, and then 4 years ago I ended up moving up to northern Sonoma County to help open up Cyrus Restaurant. And it was only then when I really got a chance to get in touch with a lot of farmers that live in this area and get to work directly with them to grow things specifically for the bar at Cyrus. So the book is kind of an obsession on seasonal produce and about how you can process, you know, different kinds of fruits and herbs and everything you can think of for use in more interesting cocktails. And also there's a strong focus on artisanal distilleries, because in the Bay Area there's a lot of wonderful small distilleries like St. George, who makes Hangar One Vodka, Domaine Charbet, Germaine Urban, all these wonderful, you know, handcrafted spirits that come out of this area. It's kind of a marriage of those two things.
Well, now, do you have farmers that grow things specifically for you for the bar, or is it that you see what the farmers are growing and so you position yourself to be there when things are ripe and being harvested?
It was a little bit of both. And then there's also things that are in the wild out here that you can get, like blackberries and huckleberries, wild grapes, all kinds of things.
We were out.
This is Healdsburg is a small town. There's only 11,000 people that live here. So there's two weekly farmers markets, and there's also about a half dozen farms which are just within the city limits. So you end up becoming friends with these people if you go to their farms to pick up ingredients or see them at the farmers markets. And a lot of the more interesting things that I used at the bar program at Cyrus while I was there for 3 years was born out of conversations we'd have at a bar, at like midnight, picking through a seed catalog, looking at what might be interesting, this flower or this herb or this, this berry, whatever it was, and then having the farmers, give it a try and grow it. And a lot of things worked out, some didn't, but that's just part of the deal.
Well, what we found is, and the farmers are interested in that trial and error. A lot of the farmers, not all the farmers, obviously there are certain people who kind of want to just do their thing and their days are long enough. But there are definitely some farmers out there right now who really enjoy this and love seeing, that their prized blackberry mint end up in one of your cocktails.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
One of the things that we find we do, and we don't go to the extent of having farmers grow things for the bar specifically, though we have a number of farmers we do meet with in the cold winter months, like just about now, and go through seed catalogs and pick out. We have a couple of small farms and gardens where people will grow specifically through us. And what's interesting with the restaurant is we're able to get some interesting things grown for us. And what we do on our side is we share some of the risk with the farmer, and we promise that when this harvest comes due, we will take it all because we have become very adept at canning and preserving and putting things up. So we can, I don't have to use it all in the same week if it's something that comes up in a particular week. You talk a lot about preserving fresh ingredients as well. It doesn't have to be something that's fresh off the farm, you run into the restaurant and make it in a cocktail that night. You put up some stuff as well.
Well, we had a pretty small bar program at Cyrus. It's only a 20-seat bar. The most dinners that we can do is 80-85. So we're not talking about having a huge program. It's a small place. So I tried to just sort of stay on top of what was peaking. Because I could, because there were lots of other options out there. But if you were to have a bigger bar program, there's no reason why you couldn't, buy things in bulk and freeze juices, freeze berries, pickle things, dehydrate fruit. There's all kinds of other options that you have.
In your book, you talk about pickling and dehydrating.
Yeah. There's two different pickling recipes in there. And I'm also a huge fan of dehydrating fruit, particularly things that come out in the fall. Like persimmons, different kinds of apples, different kinds of pears. You don't even need a food dehydrator to do it. You can use your oven at home. If you just set it at about, 170, 180 degrees and just, cut thin slices of fruit in there and lay them out on parchment paper or a Silpat, it'll do its thing within about 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I spent some time in Egypt, so I know exactly what you're talking about. As I got dehydrated myself, in temperatures pretty close to that.
Let's talk about pickling, though. That's something that an art that's was really lost, and there's a huge interest in food in general, and fermented foods and pickled foods. I think you're going to see a lot of those in the coming years. Talk to us about pickling and how you pickle for a cocktail.
I didn't really get into it until I started working at Cyrus. Our chef, Douglas Keene, used to work at Les Panas in New York City under Greg Kuntz, and he picked up this particular pickling recipe for a pickling liquid that is in my book. And for some reason, it's just the most complex and delicious pickling liquid I've ever seen. It almost has like an Indian-like edge to it without being overpowering. So I noticed a lot of things in the Cyrus walk-in and in the Cyrus kitchen that he would pickle. And decided to try to incorporate some of those things into the program. The first things I started doing were Nardello peppers, which is kind of like a bell pepper. It's not particularly spicy, a little bit longer, usually red when they're ripe. And I pickled some thin slices of that with hotter chilies in there as well, like Fresnos or little Thai chilies. And that became a component of a drink that I did called an Irian Jaya, which had Indonesian flavors in it. Kaffir lime vodka, candied lemongrass, little threads of kaffir lime leaf, fresh lime juice, ginger beer, and some of those pickled spicy peppers. And that ended up becoming a huge hit at Cyrus, so that sort of started getting me going on the pickling tip, and then I ended up doing all kinds of other things. Even things that are almost offensive, like daikon. You ever...
daikon radishes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pickled radishes have a really funky, like low-tide sort of aroma to them. But if they're one component in a drink, I think it's almost like musk is in a cologne.
Uh-huh.
You know, you would never wear all musk, but if you have a little bit in there, it actually, you know, can end up being complementary to the other things in there, which are less pungent.
You know, I'm going to make some of my listeners mad, but I thought of a joke when you talk about that low tide smell, that kind of garbage scow smell of you know, have vegetal vaguely rottingness.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
That you know, it's funny because we were joking about that in the bar the other night, because we have our cocktail bar is Catherine Lombardi Cocktail Bar, named after Mark's maternal grandmother, who cooked in Brooklyn most of her life. And one of the sections on our cocktail menu is we have the boroughs, and we have a Bronx cocktail. We have Manhattan, of course. We have the Astoria cocktail for Queens. There's a Brooklyn cocktail, but I can't come up with a Staten Island cocktail. And the joke is invariably, it should smell like a garbage scow. Some pickled radishes would be the base of the... Yeah,
that
we're going to get
hilarious.
I'm going to get in trouble for that. Yeah, this is a Staten Island.
Somebody's not going to be happy with that.
Yeah, I promise you there'll be some hate mail.
There's a little piece of cabbage floating. A little piece of cabbage floating on top, and it's garnished with a pelican. With a seagull. Anyway.
It's a bird feather in it.
Have you ever heard of a drink named after Staten Island or something related to Staten Island?
I can't say that I have. So.
It's my lifelong.
Yeah, we've been searching. We're on a quest.
I found Old Tom Gin. I can't find a Staten Island cocktail.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah. So you mentioned another ingredient that's near and dear to our hearts is ginger beer.
Uh-huh.
You write about that in your book as well. What is your criterion for a great ginger beer? What do you say makes a great soda or not a great soda? I think we have a lot of similar philosophies with regard to carbonation and soda.
The two brands that I ended up latching onto were Cock and Bull and also Bundaberg. The funny thing is I actually prefer Cock and Bull in cocktails because it has this great little bite to it. The unfortunate thing is it has high fructose corn syrup in it, which I try to avoid at all costs, you know, for a variety of reasons.
Let's stop there for one second. I find that when there's high fructose corn syrup, even if you're putting 2 ounces of soda in a drink, if it's got high fructose corn syrup in it as opposed to sodas that don't have high fructose corn syrup in it, it can really affect the drink incredibly dramatically. Am I imagining things, or is that your opinion as well?
For me, it's more principle. You could be absolutely right. I've never done, you know, side-by-side, you know, taste tests with things that have high fructose corn syrup in them and those that don't. But I just, you know, when you read about, you know, the history of that particular product and the stuff that it's in, and it's just so completely, you know, unnatural, you know, and it apparently is causing all kinds of health problems in people that live in this country. And it pretty much is only in this country where it's put into everything that you can think of.
But it is in about two-thirds of our food, so.
Yeah, if you go into a place like a gas station, I did this the other day with a friend of mine, it is in virtually everything that you could eat at a gas station.
Well, and you know, it's funny.
From the candy, the bubble gum, the potato chips, to the sodas, to everything. It's everything.
It's not in the matches, though. You could probably get some matches.
It's funny when you travel abroad, though. I was in Ireland last year. I was in Austria the year before. And, you know, you'd pull over anywhere and grab a soda, and it's sugar is the ingredient.
Mexico, it's the same thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have Mexican restaurants here in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and Mark and I seek out the Mexican Coke. It says Hecho en Mexico in a glass bottle, and it's because it doesn't have the high fructose corn syrup. It makes a difference in how it tastes, and it really makes a difference in the mouthfeel. But I have done the side-by-sides looking for ginger ale and ginger beer myself. Anything, when you remove the high fructose corn syrup, it dramatically affects the cocktail, the rest of the cocktail.
Well, there's two reasons why you should avoid it. I mean, I love ginger beer. I think some other brands like Reed's, which are just delicious, you know, on their own, I found can be a bit overpowering in cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
Bundaberg is the other one that I like to use in drinks. It's from Australia, which I kind of, you know, was apprehensive about using simply for the fact that it's from Australia, you know, which coming to the West Coast is traveling thousands of miles. But it is just cane sugar in there. It's a fairly milder flavor, but I think it works really well in drinks.
Should I tell him, Mark, or should I protect our source?
No, go ahead and tell him.
That we have, and I'm so loathe.
Our source protects itself, though.
I'm so loathe to put this on the radio, because if everybody starts to want these, we make our own ginger beer. But we make a flat ginger beer that we then introduce to a carbonated made ginger beer from South Carolina. Have you ever heard of Blenheim Bottlers?
How do you spell it now?
Blenheim Bottlers. Blenheim. Blenheim Bottlers.
No.
They make this really, they make hot and not so hot. And the not so hot's pretty darn hot. That's what we use. And then we infuse our own infused ginger juice into that whenever something calls for a ginger ale or a ginger beer.
Wow.
It's so wonderful. But it's this tumble-down little factory. They make it by hand. It's very nice one. Picks up the phone whenever you order. And most of the time when you call to order, they don't have it.
Actual things that they said to us.
No, and let me do it with the accent. Because you call them and be like, blend and bottlers. They're like, hey, I'd like to order 10 cases of ginger ale. They're like, oh, we're out of bottles, so we can't make any ginger ale right now. We think they'll be coming in next week sometime. Why don't you call us back? Well, can I just leave an order and you make it? No, why don't you just call us back in a week or two? You call them back? Yeah, we got the bottles, but we're out of sugar. We're waiting for some sugar. And so when we get this stuff, it's like the Holy Grail. I got 10 cases right before Christmas. I was like doing a little dance in the bar. So blend and bottles, check it out.
When you find something that's that fantastic, you know, and yes, it's difficult to get and they don't make a lot of it and there's always problems with sourcing it out, but once you find something that's that wonderful, it really makes a difference in, you know, in the drinks that you're producing. And I think it could be something like what you're talking about, or an herb, or a fruit, or a type of liquor. You know, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's fun to sort of, you know, seek these things out and you know, pour that passion into your drink making. You know, that's a lot of what my book is about.
You use the word artisanal in the title of your book, and I think that small production doesn't always mean artisanal. Okay. Artisanal means made by an artisan. You know, we were talking a little while back with Dana Cowan from Food and Wine Magazine. And, you know, what she mentioned in our show was that putting certain cocktail ingredients in the wrong hands is a lot like putting foam in the wrong hands of a chef, and that you can just kind of mix drinks together, and before you know it, you got something that tastes like soap. Artisanal cocktails have to be thoughtful. They can't you can't just grab some blackberries and some mint and some cowhide and put it in a cocktail and think that it's all going to taste well.
Though the cowhide...
I definitely agree with you. I mean, I think every ingredient that's in there should be appropriate. And I think it should be in the proper amount, which is why, I mean, if people take anything from my book, I think it would be that you need to measure everything that goes into a cocktail, you know, so that you can hear all of the ingredients that are in there when you're done with it. And there should never be too much or too little of anything that's in there. And when you garnish it, you know, you shouldn't just take, you know, any old thing and just stick it in there. It should be an appropriate garnish, you know.
When we come back, I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more with Scott Beatty about his wonderful book, Artisanal Cocktails, which you can find and actually purchase through our website at restaurantguysradio.com. And we're going to talk about the types of spirits that are used in cocktails, and really, we're going to talk about bar snobbery, and are there any spirits that are to be avoided? So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, WCTCAM.com and restaurantguysradio.com.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa? You can get a foot massage.
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
On the practical side again, it's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport, there's a direct train from New Brunswick, and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700, visit theheldrich.com, or click through the link on our website, ask for the Restaurant Guys promo, or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, the stage left in Catherine Lombardi and Catherine Lombardi Cocktail Bar in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Scott Beatty. He's the author of a wonderful new book on cocktails called Artisanal Cocktails, Drinks Inspired by the Seasons from the Bar at Cyrus. I want to talk about seasons in a moment, but before we get there, there's a certain bar snobbery that, honestly, I practice to a certain extent, but it can be taken a little too far. I know certain bars that, like, if you go in and ask for a vodka, they'll be like,
We don't have vodka here.
Oh, no.
You idiot. We don't have vodka here. Because vodka is a flavorless liquor that, you know, it's not the favorite ingredient for most cocktailians, for most cocktails. But there are definitely, there's a hierarchy of ingredients. And it's not necessarily that the best ingredients are the most expensive ingredients. But, you know, what about ingredients like Goldschlager and apple pucker and ingredients that have a taste that's appealing and immediately appealing to a lot of people?
Butterscotch schnapps.
Butterscotch schnapps from...
Well, Lou. I mean, I think that the way a lot of those things got incorporated into bar programs was that you're taking people who, you know, when they're younger are eating candy their whole life and drinking soda pop, and then when they become of drinking age, they're not really going to start drinking single malt scotch or small batch bourbon. You know, they're going to want to get the feeling of alcohol without the flavor of alcohol. I think that's the natural transition, and that's why, you know, all those apple martinis and, you know, slippery, buttery nipples or whatever they are in bars, because it's easy for people that are kind of college age to drink those. You know, Goldschlager, shots of Jägermeister.
Well, but you know what? Here's what I don't get, okay? And I keep a bottle of apple pucker behind the bar because there are people who
want that. That's what they want.
Want that drink, and I'm going to give it to them because, well, they've got $10. So, but
yeah.
But and also, if that's what you want, I'm not here to make you drink something you don't want to drink. So I will make the apple pucker quote unquote martini. But I have on my cocktail list a drink called a Thin Apple Lizzie, which is a very delicious drink made with bonded applejack, good apple cider,
right, local apple cider,
and you know, it's got a good acidity to it. It's a little bit sweet. It's a very accessible drink. And I think someone who likes candy would like this drink. But, you know, if you're looking for a Jolly Rancher, you know, kind of fake taste, I'm amazed at the number of people who have the real apple and then choose to go back to the stick with the apple pucker.
I think people that like apple pucker drinks, I think that the next thing for them to drink would be something that's more sort of citrus, berry, sour-driven, and something that has apple, you know, apple...
Right? Actual apple in it.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it seems like, oh, well, if you like apples, you like this, too. Because the flavor of apple pucker is so pretty much unnatural, I think they're going to be more inclined to try something that's more sort of citrus, sour, berry-driven. That's what I've done with people in the past. Because the last two bars that I've worked at, which were Cyrus and also Martini House in St. Helena, you know, I had to fight the management tooth and nail to get them not to... To stock that stuff. And they said, fine, if we're not having this, what are you going to serve instead? And that was kind of my challenge, was to come up with something which would appease these people. Not so much at Cyrus, we never had it there, but at Martini House in St. Helena, I mean, I actually enjoyed the process of trying to get people not to drink that particular drink.
Did you find ever that you just had times when you weren't successful, when people came in and ordered something that, well, stupid, and then
not stupid.
I'm sorry.
No, I know what you're saying.
And you tried your best to say, you know, I don't have that, but I do have this really good thing, and it just didn't work, and they looked at you like you had three heads and walked out.
Occasionally, yeah, but I think far more often than not, you're successful. You know, and I think things like a properly made mojito for people, you know, is usually going to work, and especially because it's so hot in Napa Valley and in Sonoma where I live during the summer, you know, people were generally appeased with that, like a really fresh mojito with good rum in it. That usually was able to appease them. And also, you know, a properly made cosmopolitan. You know, a cosmopolitan, people knock it up, but it's actually a tasty drink if you measure out all the ingredients and you use a really good base liquor like, you know, Hanger One Buddha's Hand Citron Vodka, for example. And, you know, throw a hefty dose of lime juice in there, real cranberry juice, you know, unsweetened cranberry juice.
And a lot of people don't realize, I mean, yes, the Cosmopolitan was popularized by Sex and the City, but it has a long pedigree. I hear that it originated in San Francisco. The commonly accepted drink recipe now is largely credited to the gentleman we mentioned earlier, our mutual friend Dale DeGroff, who's as serious a cocktailian as cocktailians can be. And it's also something that's widely accessible in you know, your average bar that might not specialize in cocktails.
It's a gateway cocktail.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly,
yeah,
what I was going
to
say.
If you can get people to enjoy, like, let's say, a properly made Cosmopolitan, maybe they're going to be up for trying something like a Last Word next. You know, a drink
last
that's
word.
Equal parts gin, green chartreuse, maraschino liqueur, and fresh lime juice. That also falls into that sort of sour, tart cocktail realm. but it's made with drinks that, or sorry, made with ingredients that have a long history, and
you know, we're going to really post delicious. We're going to post the recipe for the last word up on our website, because if you're home, it's as easy a cocktail as you can make. Because
as long as you have green chartreuse in your house,
you do have to buy the bottle of that. But it's equal proportions. It's very simple, and you know the nice thing about a drink like a last word, I find. Maraschino liqueur and green chartreuse are a little bit uncommon. But I find that a last word is one of those cocktails that is really so much more than the sum of its parts. Like, another drink like that would be a blood and sand, which is made of cherry, herring, brandy, and scotch, and orange juice, and sweet vermouth. And, I'm pretty good at, hearing a list of ingredients and then imagining in my head how they come together. So, Mark and I do for a living. But those drinks just seem counterintuitive to me. They're much more than the sum of their parts. They're surprising. Do you find that as well?
Definitely. Well, I mean, you look at the last word specifically. I mean, you have gin, which probably has close to a dozen botanicals in it. You have, maraschino liqueur, which is really aromatic and complex and delicious. It's got notes of, like, almond in it and cherry and all kinds of things. And then the green chartreuse, which has something like 140 different botanicals that are incorporated into it. So you think about the combination that's going on in there. It is very difficult to predict it, but, I mean, it's probably my favorite drink of all. I absolutely love that cocktail,
And
it's so complex and so difficult to put your finger on, and it just works.
Like, but if you had never had one before and I gave you that list of ingredients, you'd say, I don't know about that one. Am I right?
Absolutely. I don't know how that came about. It seems like it might have been a variation on an aviation.
Either that was an accident. Someone was cleaning up the bar and they had a little bit left in each bottle.
Yeah, and you can only surmise that the name came from somebody going, that is the last one. That's it, period. You'll never make a better drink than that. And it might be true,
Scott, I want to go back to something we touched on just a moment ago. We talked about the Cosmopolitan being a gateway cocktail for a lot of people. It was a cocktail where, if made correctly, had fresh juices and could be, for a lot of people, was their first real cocktail. But I view the Cosmopolitan a little bit differently, and I see it truly as a gateway cocktail, but I see it more as a gateway cocktail for the bar. Because now all of a sudden the bar had to start stocking fresh lime juice.
Yes.
If you want to make a real cocktail, you better, a real Cosmopolitan, one that doesn't taste terrible, you better have fresh lime juice.
And what was traditional in the bars, at least in the Northeast, was you would always have a bottle of Rose's lime juice behind the bar, which is a preserved lime juice. And if you get that Cosmopolitan and it's not a little bit cloudy, it's clear, that means they used Rose's, don't even sip it, just order a beer and have a beer. Would you agree with me on that, or do you think Rose's has an application there?
I actually like the flavor of Rose's. I mean, I never had it, or I didn't have it behind the last two bars that I worked at, because I love the flavor. I mean, you usually use it for a gimlet, right? I mean, that's what most people.
Right.
That's why you have it there.
Well, a lot of people use it for Cosmopolitans around here. Bad choice.
You could.
Bad choice.
But I love the flavor of a very fresh gin or vodka gimlet so much better than the one that has Rose's lime juice in it.
Oh, yeah, a ton.
But again, some people have been
conditioned.
If you're drinking a gimlet, there's something very specific that you're looking for.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's tough. It's an ongoing battle, but I mean, if you look at the history of drinking cocktails in this country, I mean, there was a time a long time ago when making drinks was considered an art form. You spent years being an apprentice. You didn't just hop back there because, you had a pretty face and, were charming. It was like you actually had to know how to make a whole repertoire of delicious drinks. Once Prohibition kicked in, that pretty much, killed it all. And once Prohibition was over, with the exception of a few notable tiki bars here and there, the attention to quality and drink making, didn't return. So for a long, long time, for decades, people, haven't been drinking very well at bars. They've been drinking things that work, which is fine. They drink their straight whiskey, they drink their gin martinis, they drink their their gimlets with Rose's lime juice, and that lasted for decades and decades. It's a very, very recent phenomenon when people, for people to be enjoying quality drinks again, and the public isn't entirely trusting of bartenders, I think, because they expect bartenders to produce, cocktail making meant things with silly names, that gave them a headache and a bad hangover.
Can I just
slow process? Now we're starting to show them that you can have better drinks. you know, better tasting drinks made with quality ingredients. You know, we're back. This is what we're doing.
I do miss names like the Fuzzy Wuzzy Woo Woo, though. That was a great one. That was my favorite name.
So Scott, do you think there's a correlation to a drink like the Cosmopolitan really taking America by storm and bars kind of paying attention to that and saying, you know what, now I have fresh lime juice, maybe I'll make some fresh lemon juice, maybe I'll make my own sour mix?
Well, why do people want to put fresh lime juice and fresh lemon juice in cocktails? I think the reason is that it makes, you know, a properly balanced cocktail that falls into the sort of sour realm, which is what we're talking about, really makes your mouth happy. You know, you don't want something too sweet. You don't want something too tart. You can't have something that's made with not very good quality liquor. So if you have a drink, say a margarita, for example, which is made with a great tequila, Cointreau, fresh lime juice, and simple syrup or agave nectar, and it's balanced, it's just going to make your mouth happy. You know, there's no denying it. It's like having, what's an example, like a really great grilled skirt steak, which is, you know, fairly fatty with a high-acid chimichurri sauce that has lots of vinegar in it. You know, it just makes your mouth happy. That's what a really balanced cocktail does, and that's why people, you know, have been stocking their bars with all this fresh juice, because it makes a difference. There's just no denying it. You know, your mouth's happy.
And Scott, everybody likes a happy mouth.
Yeah.
If you would like to make your mouth happy, you can come have a cocktail at our bar, or you can go pick up Scott Beatty's book on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. It's called Artisanal Cocktails. It's delicious, it's beautiful, and Scott, thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I can't wait to, you know, clink glasses with you one day out there.
Thanks so much, Scott.
I can't wait for that very... I'm not making him a cocktail. He's intimidating me. I'm not doing that. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, WCTCAM.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking and at the same time rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the 7 most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolit? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys. Love talking to that guy. Really a great book. I think 2 amazing cocktail books have come out. His and Dale Groff's new book are really important. But there's a new product that's become available that I want to point out to people. A lot of people are pointing to 2009 being a trend for artisanal gins. Genever, which is a low-proof, high-flavor, old-fashioned, slightly sweet...
Super junipery...
Dutch gin.
Yeah.
Right? And that is both an ingredient and something to, you know, just sip.
Just based on its own.
Also, there are a number of companies now who make an Old Tom gin, which is an old-fashioned form of gin, which has a little bit of sweetness to it. We have Heyman's at the bar at Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi. And so that's something else to look for because, you know, a lot of these old cocktail recipes require old ingredients like this that weren't readily available. We've always gone to great lengths to make sure that we have them. And, boy, they've been great lengths sometimes to have them behind our bar. But you're going to see them more widely available.
I also want to give you a little piece of advice to people out there. And you're seeing more and more of these ingredients out there. And the ingredients I'm talking about right now are vermouth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There are white vermouth and red vermouth out there that are of super quality and very, very different than what you standard are buying in your supermarket and not terribly expensive.
But there are very few of them, and you're not going to see them in your local liquor store unless you ask or unless it's a great liquor store. And I want to point out, Via makes a good American vermouth style vermouth. then there was a vermouth made by Duckhorn Winery called King Eider.
Oh, it was great.
It was an amazing white vermouth made with a Sauvignon Blanc base, and people still ask about it. I loved that stuff. They stopped making it.
Yeah.
I still have one bottle unopened in my refrigerator, and I just can't bring myself to open it, but it was delicious.
You know, Duckhorn's not owned by Duckhorn anymore.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So, yeah, Duckhorn was sold by the Duckhorns and is owned by...
Maybe they should go into vermouth making because that was delicious.
What a great idea. Let's call them up. Ask them if they'll make us some vermouth.
But there is a new vermouth available in the United States recently, brought in by a guy named Eric Seed, who's an importer and a distributor of a lot of these fine spirits. And it's the Dolin is the producer of this vermouth, and it's a French vermouth. Now, most vermouth is just a generic industrial product. And there are some good sweet ones that we've had. Carpano is an Italian vermouth, and Italy is known for its sweet vermouths or red vermouths. And the Antica formula from Carpano, which is the same company that makes one called Puntimes, is delicious. But Dolin is a French company, and they are from Chambéry. And Vermouth de Chambéry, it's a place near in the Duchy of Savoie, before it was France. That is the only appellation.
Boy, you knew some really minute.
I know. It's all about beverage. But this Dolin Vermouth de Chambéry, Vermouth de Chambéry is the only appellation, the only appellation, the only government sanctioned area of artisanally produced vermouth. I've been trying to get Vermouth de Chambéry in the country.
For years.
For 10 years. 10 years it's been. And occasionally I would bring some back in my suitcase if I was going to France, but, you know, for my personal consumption, Eric Seed has brought Dolin Vermouth de Chambéry, three different styles, two white vermouths. One's called a dry, the other one's called a white, which is a little bit sweeter, and a red vermouth. It's the whites that I'm most interested in. Super flavorful and interesting. And if you ever see an old movie where someone's drinking a vermouth on the rocks, and then you went to your local bar and tried to drink a stock white vermouth on the rocks.
Have you ever tried to drink just plain vermouth on the rocks? It is one of the most hideous drinks on the planet, unless it's a real vermouth.
Like King Eider, I used to drink on the rocks in the summertime.
The real vermouths, you won't believe it's the same drink. But you just won't believe it's it shouldn't have the same name.
Right. So to drink the stock sweet, dry vermouth, really a hard experience. And the Noli Prat, which is the French white or dry vermouth, it's nothing interesting. It's not really all that pleasant, but it's an okay ingredient.
It's unpleasant.
But it's an okay ingredient in a martini. But if you try to make an old-fashioned martini, what they call a fitty-fitty, 50-50, the, you know, 50% vermouth.
Nobody calls it a fitty-fitty.
Go to the Pegu Club, they call it a fitty-fitty. And it's 50% vermouth and 50% good gin.
Mm-hmm.
If you make it with Noli Prat, which is a good commercial vermouth, it's just not that good or interesting. We're running them this weekend in the bar now. I'm running a Fitty Fitty because with a 50% Dolin dry vermouth or Dolin white vermouth and 50% gin, it's a delicious cocktail.
And very interesting cocktail.
And, you know, we have our martinis. People think, oh, a martini, I can't touch that. Well, why? Because it's 99% gin or 97% gin or 95% gin. Of course, it's basically chilled straight-up gin. But vermouth is just a fortified wine. Mm-hmm. You put in 50% vermouth, and all of a sudden it's a cocktail you can
much
have...
much softer drink.
You can have more than one of.
Yeah.
And it just knock you out.
Well, depends on the size.
Doesn't knock me out. I'm a professional. Anyway, well, I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I know that we certainly have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, WCTCAM.com, and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.